Hey, this is Kyle Clark. You're listening to the podcast version of Next. Catch us live weeknights at 6 Mountain Time on 9 News and streaming live same time on 9 News Plus. Email me anytime at next@9news.com. The city of Denver says the reason that tornado sirens went off yesterday when there was no threat of a tornado in town is because somebody called 911 thinking they saw a tornado. Then the fire department activated the sirens. The city admitted to our Mark Salinger the obvious. There's a breakdown procedure.
In the middle of rain, wind, and severe weather on Monday, Denver's tornado sirens blasted around the city for 3 full minutes. A sound save for the most dangerous circumstances that never should have been heard in the city yesterday.
What happened yesterday is not our process, it's not our protocol.
Loa Escalin Garcia with the Office of Emergency Management admits the sirens were activated inadvertently by the Denver Fire Department. Someone called 911 to report a tornado. That report somehow made its way to a small team of 5 people on shift with Denver Fire that had access to activating the city's sirens. Someone on that team started the sirens, even though there wasn't a confirmed tornado or even a tornado warning.
A very well-intended employee trying to see the safety of our residents got a call about sighting of a tornado and activated the sirens without the verification process. He didn't follow the protocol.
Denver Fire, Denver International Airport, and the city's Office of Emergency Management all have access to activating the city's tornado sirens, both through a cloud-based system and physical buttons. This is for redundancy in case of a real emergency, which this was not.
Public trust is probably the most important piece in this entire system.
Eddie Bertola is the founder of the Alerting Authority, specializing in emergency alerts. This is now the third time this year Denver has mistakenly sent out emergency alerts to the entire city or used alerts when they weren't warranted.
Every time you have a mistake, whether it's a legitimate software issue, whether it's a personnel issue, or at this point, leadership issue, it takes away and chips away at that public trust.
We have a lot of work to do to regain that trust and the confidence on the systems.
Now we know why the sirens were activated, but the damage and the scare is done.
Denver's Office of Emergency Management says the Denver Fire employee meant well and just wanted to keep the city safe. Standard protocol is that once a tornado warning is issued by the National Weather Service, the sirens are automatically activated and a wireless alert is sent out to phones in the city. There was a tornado watch yesterday, but not a tornado warning at the time that this all happened, Kyle.
Mark, it seems like each time it's a new, fresh error.
Yeah, a couple times ago, it was a shelter in place that should have just been sent out to a small number of people, but was sent out to the city. Then there was also another one. One of those was a software issue. The other was human error as well.
Mark Salinger, thank you. There should be alarm bells going off in the Denver mayor's office, just like the tornado siren set off an error across Denver yesterday. Latest in a string of botched emergency alerts in the city. So for the first time in the 10-year history of this program, I have called in a backup on a commentary because meteorologist Chris Bianchi knows how to get people's attention to save lives.
It is vital, that people trust emergency alerts, whether it comes from us, local government. Every time a warning gives people bad information or misleading info, trust in every warning is eroded. It's size. Trust me, when people get incorrect emergency alerts, they're probably going to ignore the next one, and that could really cost lives.
So Denver has followed up each of these failures with a pledge to do better, right? To stop alerting the whole city for danger in one small area, to stop directing people online for information, then offering nothing there, to stop firing off the city's tornado sirens because of a scary-looking storm that did not include a tornado. So it is time now to shift the responsibility from individual human error to the human who is in charge of the city, Denver Mayor Mike Johnston.
And so, Mayor Johnston, people need to trust that the next time they're told to run for the basement, that's not human error and it's not hype. Communicating about future threats, it's challenging. Trust me, I know, I predict the living future for a living, but Denver must fix these unforced errors.
Spoke briefly with the mayor a short time ago. I think he gets it, that whatever the city has been doing to eliminate its frequent human errors and emergency communications is not working. Denver just keeps finding new ways to mess things up. The stakes are too high. The mayor needs to take charge himself, explain how this will be fixed, and and fix it fast. The private prison contractor Geo Group, which operates immigrant detention facilities across the country, is currently suing to keep state regulators out of their detention center in Aurora. A new Democrat-backed state law would authorize more frequent and expansive state inspections at ICE detention facilities and require those detention centers to pay for environmental impact studies. Facilities that don't comply could face fines or lose their license. The GEO Group says the law goes beyond the state's authority. The state cannot interfere with federal immigration operations. They're now asking a federal court to stop that law from being enforced. When the Trump administration announced plans to denaturalize some citizens who had become Americans, critics feared it would be used as a tool against the president's political enemies. Our Angeline McCall found the current cases include one in Colorado. It's not about politics, but about honesty.
17 people across the country are at risk of losing their U.S. citizenship. It may not seem like a lot, but experts say otherwise.
So this really reflects the Trump's general administration, focus on immigration enforcement, right, and really a hard stance on that.
Professor Robert Preuss, political science chair at MSU Denver, calls this case number unprecedented. Compared to the Biden administration, just 24 denaturalization cases were filed for all 4 years. And on average, we've seen no more than 11 cases per year until now.
Really revoking individual citizenship and targeting that in such a large fashion really is somewhat unique, but also really reflective of the hardcore stance that the Trump administration has taken against immigration, undocumented immigration in particular.
One of the cases, a Colorado woman, Maria Montoya, who has been a citizen since 1997. Court documents allege she was, quote, ineligible for citizenship because she applied through a spouse. The documents say her husband was never a United States citizen, but had assumed the identity of one who had passed away. The Department of Justice has filed to revoke her citizenship in Colorado federal court 14 years after her husband was prosecuted.
Most of it really is about that process. So did you commit a crime prior to becoming a citizen, which would make you ineligible because you don't have good moral character? Or did you commit fraud or identity fraud or conceal something in your application process?
Preuss says the current effort is looking at how people became citizens and alleging they shouldn't have qualified in the first place. He says it's a rare move compared to previous administrations, but one we may continue to see from the Trump administration as the president targets immigration enforcement.
That was Angeline McCall reporting. So when someone is denaturalized, they typically would revert back to their prior immigration status, like lawful permanent resident, though we also know the Trump administration has pushed the bounds of what typically happens. So we will be watching to see what happens in those 17 cases and whether they will try to strip people of their prior status as well. Two Democrats are competing for the chance to take on Republican Congressman Gabe Evans in the 8th Congressional District north of Denver up to Weld County. In their debate last night on 9 News, State Rep Manny Rutenell walked back or abandoned his former positions on agriculture, health care, student debt, and fracking. You said earlier in this campaign that you support a universal single-payer health system. Is that still your position?
Look, I grew up on Medicaid, and so I know how important it is for us to be able to have affordable, accessible healthcare. I think that we need to be pushing for a public option, and we also need to be restoring the cuts to Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act that Donald Trump has inflicted on the people of this district.
With respect, sir, that's a lot of words, and none of them are an answer to the question. You said earlier in this campaign you support a universal single-payer health system. Is that still your position?
We need to be looking for actionable solutions.
With respect, what should voters discern from the fact that you won't answer a question about your own position earlier in this campaign? You said you supported universal single-payer. Do you still support that?
You know, like I said, we need actionable solutions to the issues that Donald Trump and Gabe Evans
have. Okay, if you're going to refuse to answer, we'll move on. Do you support a ban on fracking?
I believe in an all-of-the-above energy system.
This is a yes or no question,
no.
Sir. You do not support a ban on fracking. Okay. Earlier in this campaign, you said that you did support a ban on fracking. Why did you change your position?
You know, like I've said before, Donald Trump has sent us into a forever war with Iran without any plans and raised gas prices across the board.
So if the war on Iran ends, will you go back to your previous position in this campaign in opposition to fracking?
I believe in all of the above energy system.
It's a very simple question. If the war on Iran ends, will you go back to your previous position?
Like I said, I believe in an all of the above energy system.
If you're not going to answer, we can move on. Manny Reunel continued to display impressive ideological flexibility, as the former vegan activist also told me during the debate that he's no longer a vegan, quote, because I think that it's important for me to be able to enjoy the delicious products that Colorado ranchers make. Reunel's opponent, former state rep Shannon Byrd, defended her votes with Republicans as one of the most centrist Dems at the state house. And she talked about the negative influence of dark money, which is weird because...
Ms. Byrd, you founded the Opportunity Caucus. That was a group of moderate Democrats in the state legislature. You wrote in an op-ed announcing the caucus, quote, all hardworking Coloradans need champions who prioritize solutions over sound bites. I should, to be more accurate, the head of a dark money group called One Main Street wrote that op-ed, gave it to you, and told you to put your name on it, and you did. That was the same dark money group that bankrolled your Opportunity Caucus. Was this really about bipartisan consensus, or was this just pay-to-play politics that was dressed up as consensus?
Kyle, I just reject your framing of the question. So this was a group that was founded to make sure that Democrats were being intentional about focusing on affordability and opportunity. So the group wasn't, during my time with that group, there was no fundraising, no funding of the group.
Are you comfortable with the fact that it became a way for oil and gas companies and other conservative interests to funnel money to centrist Dems?
I believe that transparency is key, and all caucuses should be disclosing their donors.
You see that full 8th Congressional District Democratic debate on the next YouTube channel or on 9news.com.
It's not just about what we want to remember, it's about what we have to remember, and it's about what people other than us remember.
People from all walks of life have left a lasting impact on Colorado's 150 years. Some we remember more than others. A museum in Pueblo is highlighting hidden names. Next. Keeping an eye on a fast-moving fire near Glenwood Springs. Paradise Fire shut down I-70 both ways. Glenwood Springs Fire says it's gone through about 10 acres. They've shut down the interstate in South Canyon at mile marker 112. Nobody's getting through until that fire is under control. Chris Bianchi, they're dipping water out of the Colorado River right there, close at hand.
And apparently Glenwood is full of truckers and a lot of travelers right now as people trying to get through I-70. And again, that is just west of Glenwood Springs. Unfortunately, in that area, it's really dry and pretty blustery out there as well. We're starting to see those winds kick up here along the I-25 corridor. We've had them for the last few hours. Those winds will back down tonight, but then they'll pick back up for tomorrow. So unfortunately, we're going to be looking at another inside of a hairdryer day again for us tomorrow. Temperatures near 90 and 30 to 35, maybe even 40 miles. On our winds stronger than that in the foothills. Fire weather warning until 9 p.m. tonight. We're going to likely see that continue tomorrow. Fire weather warning continues for tomorrow, I should say, for the mountains and the eastern plains, including Denver, and again, most of the eastern plains as well. There's also a severe thunderstorm watch for the, it's been canceled, but we did have a severe thunderstorm watch for the far eastern plains. Showers and storms, though, starting to push off into Kansas and Nebraska, so it should be a quieter night at least in terms of thunderstorms. Next few days, dry and warm is the story, but then this weekend, showers and storms return Sunday and Monday, and notably cooler temperatures as well, starting on Sunday.
Colorado is the state we know because of people we don't. We'll meet some unsung heroes of state history as we celebrate 150 years. Buffalo Bill, Doc Holliday, Kit Carson, names you know in early Colorado history. As we recognize the state's 150th birthday, historians at El Pueblo History Museum are highlighting some less familiar names.
I've got a stack of photos from, most of them are from the History Colorado collection. There's a lot of people who don't necessarily immediately come to mind when people think about Colorado history, but they played a huge part in forming Colorado as it is today. This is Casimiro Barrela. He was a legislator, first for the Colorado Territory and then later on for the state of Colorado. And he's actually the reason why Colorado's state constitution was originally published in four languages. There's also sort of the everyday person that helped build Colorado as it is. A good example of that would be Teresita Sandoval. She and her family, they established a ranch in Pueblo County, raised a family here, built a life here, created a small community around her family ranch. She left a huge legacy. Jim Beckworth was a black fur trapper and mountain man in very early Colorado history. He trapped, he traded, he helped establish trails for migrants moving west to California. He was largely forgotten compared to the more typical mountain men that you still hear stories about. Chief Black Kettle, he was a chief of the Cheyenne. He and his people were betrayed. They were instructed to demonstrate their willingness for peace by camping along the Sand Creek. And it was there that he and his people were massacred. That's one of the biggest moments in Colorado history. And that is, again, that's something that is often overlooked in favor of these much more romantic stories. There's many wonderful things about Colorado to celebrate, but history is so much deeper than that. It's not just about what we want to remember, it's about what we have to remember. And it's about what people other than us remember.
What a great remembrance. Photojournalist Mike Grady, back with your feedback next. I wanted to give you an update on one of your recent acts of generosity. You raised almost $90,000 in a Word of Thanks microgiving campaign to help rebuild the City Park Bandstand in Denver, the almost 100-year-old landmark that's the centerpiece of Jazz in the Park and so many celebrations before it burned. Stop by City Park Jazz on Sunday to join the mayor as he announced that thanks to your generosity, the city's going to be able to start work on demolishing that burned bandstand and building the new one to be done in time for next summer's activities. City, of course, had insurance on the landmark, but not enough to pay for a full replacement at scale. It was kind of a grand operation. And with the city's budget strapped right now, the mayor said that they would have to delay the rebuild. They'd have to pull money from other parks projects until you all came in and raised $90,000, which means they can get started on that right away. Feedback via text tonight on the city of Denver's botched emergency alerts. Perhaps the alerts need to have two people push the button and not one person. I hear what you're saying. I don't know if the issue is that there are too many cooks in the kitchen who have access to the situation or if there need to be more minds in the loop. All I know is that the buck stops with the mayor. He needs to figure out what the problem is. And we've had mistake after mistake after mistake, excuse after excuse after excuse. They just need to fix it because a city without functioning emergency alerts is not a safe city. A note from Maggie, really appreciate your debate moderating skills. You press for specific answers to specific questions and try to keep the candidates from grandstanding. I appreciate that, Maggie. Like with anything else, the reviews vary on whether I'm competent at that, but I appreciate you tuning in, and I will see you next time. Thanks for listening to the podcast version of Next. Catch us live weeknights at 6 Mountain Time on 9 News, streaming live, same time, on 9 News Plus. Email me anytime at next@9news.com. Next producer is Mallory Harris. Our digital producer is Marilyn Moore. Our visual editor is Jeff Sartell. Our reporters include Marshall Zellinger, Mark Salinger, Angeline McCall, and Evan Kruel. Misty Montano is 9 News' digital director. I'm Kyle Clark. I'll see you next time.